Did you know, right, that you and I are another for a certain crowd?
Oh, I know.
They unite
against us.
Against us, because that helps keep them together. Like, you know, Captain and Tennille kind of got it wrong. Love, love does not keep us together, but hate is really binding.
Hi, and welcome to Gen Extemporaneous. This is a podcast where I come up with an idea, I do some research, I grab a bottle of wine, I bring everything to Mark, and he pontificates. Today, we are talking about the crowd. For over a year, we have been observing the rise and subsequent fluctuations of a crowd online dedicated initially to the fervent fandom of a TikToker. As time has gone on, the focus for me has shifted into fascination with how the fandom itself works, and beyond that, how crowds operate. In this episode, the first in a three-episode arc, Mark and I are going to explore the origins of theories surrounding crowd psychology. We are working towards an ultimate goal of drawing a correlation between calamitous events and outbreaks of mass hysteria. Who knows if we are right about our thesis, but we'll have fun trying to prove it. We are grateful to you for coming to listen to us each week, and we hope that if you enjoy us, you will share us with a friend. Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso.
All right, so Mark, today we are going to be talking about crowds, the crowd. Crowds have been a forever thing. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about some historically famous crowd situations. Some of them resulted in long-lasting change, and some of them are just for fun. Some of them we'll talk about, and they're just fun ideas. So talking about sort of historically, there are some crowds that have been what I would call revolutionary, right? Because a lot of people Sure. who study crowds, in fact, one of the theorists that we're going to hone in on next episode really kept repeating, I was reading his book, and he kept repeating things about the revolution, meaning the French Revolution.
Yeah.
So he was writing
that's a pretty famous crowd.
He was writing at the end of the 19th century. And so the French Revolution was still just like 100 years back. People of the time were still grappling, particularly if you were in France, you were still grappling with what all that meant.
They were really mad at that Bastille, I can tell you that.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
But there were all sorts of revolutionary things that happened. I mean, we can talk about the Bolshevik Revolution. We can talk about, well, for instance, let's talk about Wat Tyler and the Peasants' Revolt.
Or Prince and the Revolution, possibly.
True. All right. The Peasants' Revolt began in May 1381, and it was triggered by a recently imposed poll tax of 4 pence that was to be exacted on every adult, whether peasant or wealthy.
Okay.
So, of course, this...
Pretty regressive.
It is.
As taxes go.
But this is important because, I mean, obviously the burden on a peasant for 4 pence a year.
Right. That's like, you know, 70% of my annual income.
That's a big burden. And the wealthy paid the same thing. There was no sliding scale. Wat Tyler was the name of the leader of the peasant revolt.
Wat.
He became
that was
the
his name.
De facto...
Wat.
W-A-T.
Sound, but, I mean, if you call somebody Wat, I'm pretty sure you've relegated them to jobs like, you know, pig shit shoveling.
Well, as a matter of fact.
Or go get Ector's sword out of that stone type of thing.
But as a matter of fact, Watt's last name, they suspect that he was a Tyler. Like he was a roof. He did roofs. Well. Okay. They don't know. Of course, they don't know much about him. They just know that at a certain point here, he existed.
Right.
And he did this big deal thing and paid the ultimate price. But
was it 4 pence? He's like, you know what? I'm tired of fighting. Let's just give him their 4 pence. Honestly, I only have one arm left. You know,
my eyes been
put out. You know, 4 pence is fine. Honestly,
for a crowd to form and for ideas to take root, there has to be a foundation that has been put down. Now, that foundation is a long durée. There's a long history of foundation laying, and then all of a sudden, the crowd comes along, and some ideas pop up, and everyone goes, "Ooh." That's really revolutionary, except that ground had been prepared.
Would you say that that foundation and that groundwork was in the zeitgeist?
It is. And so what I'm going to see is if you can kind of come up with the common thread.
Oh, I'm getting tested now?
Yeah, you're going to. I'm going to see if you can come up with the common thread. Okay, so John Ball is the guy who lays the groundwork for the Peasants' Revolt. A lot of them were very sort of interested in John Ball's teachings. John Ball was preaching for the equality of people. In the sense that, of course, this is a time of serfdom. So these are not, these peasants are tied to the land. They're essentially, you know, they're essentially slaves. They're tied to the land. Right. They can't move off of the land that they're born on. There are no options for them.
So you're saying economic mobility was less than ideal.
Definitely. Okay, so now this is 1381. So this is post-plague. Right. Not by a lot, 1340, by 430 years, something like that.
So a generation removed
from the plague. But the plague then, after that, there are rolling plagues. So, I mean, plague is still going on.
Believe me, I feel you, 14th century people.
They have lost fully up to a half of the population, perhaps even more. Okay.
Yeah. Because they wouldn't put on their masks.
In the plague. Yeah, they refused to wear masks.
There are so many anti-maskers.
Well, those masks were so pointy and long.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, that seems really useful to not only keep germs out, but maybe keep people at distance. Like, you know what? I will peck you with my fucking giant crow
social
beak.
Social distancing in the time of the Black Death.
Here you go.
Death.
Plague doctor stab in the neck. Cha.
So the plague had happened, but now you have people like John Ball, who's a preacher, and he's preaching for liberty. He's also, John Ball is associated with Lollardy. Lollardy is a proto-reform group in England. So, but there are pockets of Protestantism that are popping up, and one of them is Lollardy. And they are a sect that were against many of the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, including the fact that they wanted a Bible in the vernacular. They thought that the Bible was the true source of knowledge, that was the only sort of legitimate authority.
Sola scriptura.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Correct.
Thank you.
Wow, I'm impressed.
Well, as well you should be.
All right. I wasn't going to pull out the Latin, but well done.
I beat you to it.
Which is ironic.
Cheers.
It's ironic because they wanted the Bible.
They wanted to get rid of
the vernacular.
Latin.
Yeah, they wanted to get rid of the Latin. All right. So, okay. So on 13th of June in 1381, the rebels, the peasants, reached the capital and crossed London Bridge. They want some changes made.
Darth Vader is harassing them all the time.
So they attacked civil targets, they destroyed legal records. They opened prisons and let prisoners out. That was a big deal. Like
just lolling the whole time.
And sacked homes. They killed individuals they thought were associated with the government, the royal government.
Right.
In response, King Richard II, who was at the time 14 years old, met with them on the 14th of June and agreed to make some concessions and to give full pardons to everybody who was involved in the rebellion. That's a pretty good deal.
Did he have headphones on when he did that? It's like, what's up, bro? Oh, yeah, you guys can do that. That's cool. I'm going to go back and play some Fortnite. I'm very busy.
So most of the rebels were okay with that deal, and they dispersed, but some weren't, including Watt. So
fucking Watt.
Watt decided he was going to meet with Richard II, the king. And then he was really rude. And he was like, really, he was at that point,
pretty,
you know,
bold.
He was high on power. He was on a power
trip.
High
on crack.
Mm-hmm. He was really on this power trip. And he did like unusual things. Like he drank water aggressively in front of the king. And it was
slosh, burp. What's up? Slams it down. Water goes everywhere.
He was really rude in front
of the king. Fuck you. I'll drink more water. What do you think about that, King?
So he went way too far, and they attacked him and
cut his fucking head off.
Him, and he was eventually killed.
Look, if you are living in the 14th century, you gotta be a little more circumspect and aware of, like, read the room, right? They have all the pikes and the swords.
The
swords, and all you have is like farm implements.
You've got your pitchfork.
Yeah. You're going to lose that fight 99 times out of 100.
It really was. But it was one of the first sort kind of nails in the coffin.
Right. So it really stirred the crowd.
It did. And the crowd was responsible for doing this, right? Like, so the crowd outnumbers the elite class by massive numbers.
Right. And that is historically, throughout time, has been the great fear of all monarchs, despots, whatever, is that they know that they are way outnumbered by the people that they rule, and they have to impose, you know, they have to have superior arms, and they have to control them by economic means. I mean, that is always the fear, that at some point, the peasantry well, is just going to decide, you know, that's enough, we're going to start throwing bitches out the window.
Right.
Which, you know, especially if you're in Prague.
From time to time, yeah. they do that. They rise up, and very often those things are squashed, and that isn't quashed. In the case of the Peasants'
or
Revolt.
Squished. Sometimes squished by horses.
And the Peasants' Revolt was one of those cases. They, you know, he was killed, and they were made, you know, he was made an example of, and things kind of went back to normal, but yeah. It ended up eventually helping to lead to the dissolution of serfdom in England.
Yeah.
It was finally, it took until 1570.
Oh, that's so bogus. I love serfdom. I am an idiot.
Okay, Elizabeth I, though, it finally gets rid of all serfdom in 1574 in England. So moving forward, let's talk about the Boston Tea Party.
Let's.
Okay.
Which, by the way, was not a party at all.
It was not a party.
It was not.
All right, so tell what the Boston Tea Party is.
Well, there was some shady-ass taxation shit going on, and some colonists in... Not surprisingly, Boston decided, era, we're going to throw all the tea in the harbor because we're wicked mad.
I don't know if you do a very good Boston accent.
I don't
accent.
Really. No, it's terrible. It's one of my worst ones.
So, okay, 60 men.
Led
by the Sons of Liberty.
Yes.
In response to unfair taxation. So they dressed up as Native Americans on December 16th, 1773.
Cultural appropriation.
And they had no sensitivity
At
that time.
Well, please.
No.
The opposite of sensitivity, that like outright hostility.
That's right. Okay. Just disdain. So they threw 342 chests, 92,000 pounds of tea.
Holy
into
shit.
Boston,
how big were these fucking chests?
Into Boston Harbor.
How heavy is tea? All right, yeah, there's 269 pounds of tea in each chest.
All right, so the protest was met with punishment from the Brits, as obviously
again,
it would be.
Again, not surprising.
So it was very punitive. They closed Boston's port until the debt from the Boston Tea Party was paid, and they forced people to house British troops. And,
now, do you think that... had these people seen the Breakfast Club, they would have known that if you mess with the bull, you will get the horns.
This is a very important thing that you're bringing up.
Thank you. Because
these are crowds. And as an individual,
you
would think, I won't.
This is
and
nuts.
An individual wouldn't do it. But if you are an individual backed by a crowd...
you lose your fucking mind.
But everyone, remember this point, because we will get back to it.
What, the Breakfast Club one?
No, Mark, the point about...
You lose your mind if you're in a crowd.
Lose your mind, individuality kind of goes by the wayside. Okay, so this leads to, obviously, things that cause more consternation in the colonies.
Right.
And we end up with the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Now, one of the reasons that the British did recognize U.S. independence.
Because we beat their ass.
Why were we able to do that?
We had some foreign help.
Who was our foreign help?
Oh, you know very well who it was. You filthy English kniggets. We hate you, and we're going to help those Americans kick your ass.
All right, so France comes in and helps us, but this puts an incredible financial burden on the French. So the French looked at this situation where there was a revolution against the British crown.
Yeah.
And they said, you know what? We hate Britain so much. We want to hurt them so badly. We're going to help this upstart nation and sink a ton of money. So the French are in upheaval now because they're hurting for money. And what does the government do? As soon as the leadership is hurting for money, what does the government do? Turns it around and puts the burden of that
on
the people. Well, this is Louis the 16th, right? Yeah. So
he's living the
high life, right? So and
he's a
Marie playa. Antoinette.
He's a playa.
She's got the wigs,
everything. He's
making
it rain in the strip club. He doesn't even care.
Well, I don't know.
He's like getting
really
bottle service every night.
Oh my God. That's not at all what was happening, Mark.
I think there was.
All right, but anyway.
That's pretty accurate.
But of course, that would have been the perception, right?
Like, did they have sparklers back then?
My God. All right. So there's all kinds of upheaval because the people are starving. And they can't really bear the burden. And this is here again.
The cake was not as readily available as one
Marie
might think.
That's how it might be. She didn't really say let them eat cake.
I know, but it's a good
quote. I think she said something like let them eat brioche.
Yes, exactly.
You know, there's no bread. Well, let them eat brioche.
Well, I can't. Yeah, just tell them to upgrade.
Sweet bread.
Yeah,
like there's all sorts of fervor because, of course, this is the time of the where. People are really, really impressed with Enlightenment ideas.
Yes. Even though it's, you know, a little shaky philosophically, is one of my favorite political ideologies is the Enlightenment stuff.
Liberty and
like fraternity.
The pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Especially like the fraternity part, you know, have some beers with the guys.
Of course.
That's awesome.
All right. So a lot of like bourgeois people, like they're having salons and stuff. Some of the elites are thinking about.
Define salon.
Well, you know, the rooms where they would go and they'd have these high-minded conversations.
Right.
And these are not poor people.
Yeah.
These are not peasants having these conversations.
They're not getting the gel nails.
No.
When you say salon.
No. They're sitting in there having conversations about politics and high-minded.
That would be great.
Philosophy.
I would love that.
So you have a few people who have got these high-minded ideals, and then you have the peasants who have the might of number.
Yeah,
right?
They have the numbers, and they have some baser needs, let's just say.
Yeah.
Food. You know.
On July 14th, 1789, 1,000 men, under 1,000 men, there were some governmental things happening. There were, you know, estates general and things. I'm not going to go into the details of the government stuff.
Right.
But this is the crowd right now. Under 1,000 men, mainly artisans, some regular army deserters, and oddly enough, like 46 wine merchants. I don't know.
The wine
like
merchants are pissed.
Wine merchants have had
Maybe they were just drunk.
They gathered outside the Bastille.
Oui.
And they had been whipped up into this revolutionary fervor.
Right. And someone just went, hey, have you guys ever stormed anything before? They're like, no.
Because
that sounds awesome.
Because people have now, at this point, forced Louis XVI to accept not an absolute monarchy, but a constitutional monarchy.
Constitutional monarchy, yes.
Okay. And they wanted to storm the Bastille to get at the gunpowder that had been stored in.
They weren't freeing prisoners.
There were like 7 guys.
Like, we have some really dangerous forgers, and we're just going to keep them in this giant 30,000 square foot building.
And it was heavily armed and heavily protected. But
because
that's
those forgers can really get frisky.
It's because they put gunpowder there.
Yeah.
They had already, the crowd had already stormed the location where they were keeping the guns, and then they go to the Bastille to get the gunpowder.
Now, in the U.S., that would be called the magazine.
The magazine, that's right. So anyway, the forgers were released by the storming.
Oh, no. There's been a flood of fake checks in the last week. All 7 of them furiously scribbling.
So they finally decide that they're going to give up. They say, we'll give in. We're going to surrender to these because we know that we're going to run out of food. We know that we can't withstand this siege, so we're going to give in. And they take the guy who is the main guy who's defending the Bastille, and they beat him half to death. They run him through town. They beat him half to death. And at a certain point, he just goes, for God's sakes, just let me die. And he kicks some guy in the crotch.
Nice. All right. I like his spirit.
I mean, he's beaten half to death anyway. He has the wherewithal to give a guy a humiliating kick in the crotch.
Yes, right. Thank you, le gendarme. Cha!
Ow! That's what that guy said. Like,
now, back in the day, you know what that would have been called? Kicking him in a fork.
So that's another example of a crowd, right? Where a crowd gets together. Here again, all of these are these revolutionary sort of, they lead to these momentous events.
Yeah.
And of course, the storming the Bastille leads to the French Revolution just amping up. And then to the terror, which ends up, you know, there's the French Revolution where everyone's kind of like on board, like we're going to overthrow the crown. The crown needs to be done.
Right.
And then it just continues on and it becomes the terror where
overthrow like the librarians.
Everything.
Or,
and Robespierre, he's like one of the leaders against the crown. And then at the end of the day, he gets his head chopped off.
So you have to kind of project forward and say, look, at some point, are we going to run out of targets and they're going to kill me?
That is another aspect of the crowd that I want us to remember.
Momentum.
The crowd evolves. The mood of the crowd can evolve. It can change.
They get like pseudopods.
What the original goal may be.
Yeah.
All of the sudden, things get more and more and more extreme. Suddenly, you're in a crowd and you're like, I didn't sign up for this. Yeah,
I guess we're killing everybody now. I don't know. Wait. Why are we overthrowing bakeries? Free the baguettes.
I used to be behind this.
Yeah, I'm
but
like,
I, what,
this
now?
Seems like a lot, you guys.
I thought Robespierre was our friend, yeah, and now he's lost his head. Now, am I next? Suddenly, you're looking over your shoulder and wondering, like, when is the crowd coming for me?
Yeah.
And how do I extricate myself?
I can tell you, after Robespierre gets his head chopped off, you might think twice about assuming the mantle, right? All right, we need a leader. Nope, not me.
There are other kinds of crowds. This is revolutionary. So because when we start hearing about the original theories of crowd, there was always this perception of them being in some way criminal.
Well, yeah.
Or in some way, like, how do we figure out the initial interest in crowd is about how do we figure out who to prosecute?
Yeah.
Who are the criminals in the crowd?
Right.
You can't prosecute an entire crowd.
Yeah. There's like 100,000 people. We will be in court for the next 10 years.
Right. I mean, they're like 60 guys.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, where are the wine merchants?
Yeah. We don't have that many guillotines. We don't even have that many walls to line them up against.
Right.
We're going to have to be a little selective here, people.
How do we figure out who the real bad guys are? Okay. Yeah. So, and I guess you could still say this is maybe revolutionary, but it's revolutionary on a more progressive social side of things. You're not looking to overthrow the government. You're looking to affect social
change.
Like
votes for women.
Raise social consciousness. Okay, suffragettes, that's one of them. Let's talk about, this is Pride Month, and Stonewall riots happened in from June 28th to July 3rd in 1969.
Yes.
So this is another example of a crowd who just says, this is enough. So in New York City at the time, police had a long history of raiding New York City clubs that were gay clubs.
Obviously in this day and age, it seems insane. What are you afraid of is happening? Are men having orgasms without your permission? I mean, is that your problem?
Or women.
So, but it was listed as a mental defect, as a mental illness.
Yes. Yeah. And it was illegal.
Yeah. Which is also so nuts.
It's crazy. So the police had a long history of raiding these gay bars without any repercussions against them. You know, they just go in and raid arrest people. Yeah. But in the early morning hours of June 28th, 1969, police raided the Stonewall Inn, which was a well-known Greenwich Village.
Cool name.
Totally.
Sounds like something in like Connecticut.
The LGBTQ community finally said, this is enough is enough. And protests began that same morning and continued for 6 days. So leaders for the Stonewall riots included gay liberation activists and drag queens like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera. And they ended up forming organizations throughout this period, such as the Gay Liberation Front, after the riots and pushed for policy changes and social inclusivity for the LGBTQIA+ community.
That is a group of people with a common interest, right? Because they're all looking for basically the same thing, which is don't trample on our rights because of our sexuality.
I am an ally to that community because I believe that everybody, love is love, and everybody should be able to do.
We're of a mind.
Whatever and whomever they want to, as long as it's consenting adults.
The Gen Extemporaneous podcast is fully.
Do or don't do, because we have to consider asexual.
That's
people.
Right. Do it. Don't do it. Do it with whoever you want. As long as you have consent, nobody's getting hurt without their permission. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, that's right.
Add some more letters.
That's exactly DDS. Right.
So newspapers at the time were outrageous.
Oh, I can only imagine.
And some of the headlines prompted rioting to occur outside of the offices of the newspapers. So in response, for instance, the Village Voice's coverage.
I was going to say.
The Village Voice.
Which is not exactly a bastion of conservative thought.
Not anymore. But can I just please say that the Village Voice has a dirty history.
Apparently, yeah.
And they referred
to... They got some shit to make up for.
In their coverage of the riots, they referred to the forces... I'm sorry, everyone. Trigger warning. They referred to the forces of faggotry.
I knew that exactly what you were going to say. And even though I've never read that, first of all, I guarantee you, because they're newspaper people, they're going to be alliterative, right? They just can't help themselves.
Some kind of alliteration, and there it was. Yeah. All right, so so protesters swarmed outside of the building and demanded, you know, retribution of some sort and started rioting. The New York Daily News...
I'm sure they were awful.
Kind of on brand.
Yeah.
They also resorted to homophobic slurs. And their headline was, again, everyone, trigger warning, homophobic language. Homo nest raided.
Homo nest?
Homo nest raided.
Like they're insects?
Queen bees are stinging mad.
Wow. So that is very on brand for newspapers because they love stupid ass puns like that.
Especially the Daily News. The New York Times buried the article on page 22 on June 30th and said, police again rout village youths. Village.
Yeah, because that's the code for
gay.
That's the code for gay. Yeah.
So 1 year after the historic riots happened, what we saw then was the rise of a parade. It was the first Christopher Street Liberation Day March, which is named after Stonewall Inn's location. And it was organized in New York and other U.S. cities. This march would lead to a rise in annual pride events worldwide. Good job, crowd. So here's in all of those cases, are we positive pro the crowd? Maybe the French Revolution got things a little bit.
Got a little out of control, but, you know, in general, down with the monarchy, you know, that's fine.
Okay, here's another social one. The occupation of Alcatraz. Do you know about this?
No.
Okay.
Was Clint Eastwood in that?
So in the late 60s, Alcatraz had been a prison, obviously, for the worst of the worst. But in the late 60s, they closed it. And then it just became vacant federal land. And according to a treaty, any vacant federal land was allowed to be under the control of Native Americans.
They found a loophole.
Mm-hmm. So 89 members from Indians of all tribes.
Every single one of them.
Began living.
Nez Perce, Comanche, Pueblo, so Seminole.
This is a Native American group that was advocating for rights for Native Americans. They began living on the island and continued their protests for 19 months.
Wow. Way to hang in there.
Initially, their demands were to build Native American institutions on the island. This was partly due to the fact that there had been a fire in the previous month in San Francisco of a Native American center, which helped provide jobs and health care and legal aid and other opportunities. At its height, there were 400 people living on this island.
In Alcatraz.
They lived without running water, phone service, and for some time, electricity.
Do you think, like, former prisoners are like, why would you guys break into prison? What are you doing? Go the other way.
Some of the Native Americans spoke out and said these and worse conditions were already in place on reservations.
Right.
This protest, although it didn't get them exactly what they wanted, it did bring attention to the Indian termination policy, which began in the mid-1940s, that was a series of laws that were aimed to sort of abolish Native American tribes and culture, sort of. Yeah. Because really what the whole thing about Native Americans historically was assimilation, like bring them into the fold. Right.
It's the Roman strategy.
Right. And the Native Americans are like, no, you know what? We have our culture. We would like to be our culture. Yeah. We'd like to have our culture. During the occupation of Alcatraz, Richard Nixon ended the policy that we were talking about that had been in place, the termination policy. And publicity around the event led to a new policy of self-determination for Native Americans. So it was a good and successful social change.
Yes.
Led by a crowd.
That's right. Of like-minded people. Of course.
Okay, so let's talk about one that's just for fun. A group of fun. Let's talk about Burning Man.
Ah, yes.
What do you know about Burning
Man? Those people get up to some shit, right?
What do you know about Burning Man?
So Burning Man is an annual festival that takes place in the fucking desert.
Yeah, it's called Nevada's Black Rock Desert.
Yeah, just an inhospitable place. Mm-hmm. And it's this kind of weird combination of music and art and drugs.
Well,
and
I mean, I think that
sunburns and there's just like a lot
dodgy
of
toilets.
It's a huge
latrines.
Festival of, let's just call them libertines, okay. Shall we?
Right. Okay.
And people wear like crazy costumes and sometimes no costumes at all, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, they do. A lot of them get naked.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about this. So Burning Man began in 1986 as a small gathering of friends on a San Francisco beach, and it has evolved into what you're talking about
this
now.
This giant festival.
Which is a week-long event attended by 50,000 people and sometimes more than that.
Yeah.
It takes place in, as I said, Nevada's Black Rock Desert. The name of the event comes from its culminating ceremony.
Right, where they burn a giant straw man, right? Or whatever it's made out of, wood, I guess.
Yeah, and it's referred to as the man.
The man.
The man.
Which, right. I mean, I feel a little threatened by that, I have to say.
This occurs on the penultimate night of Burning Man, which is the Saturday evening before Labor Day. This Black Rock City is a temporary city that is erected about 100 miles north-northeast of Reno.
Yeah, which is, i.e., 100 miles north-northeast of anything.
Right?
I mean, there's like scorpions and cactuses. That's about it.
All right,
cacti.
Cacti. Co-founder of Burning Man is called Larry. One of the co-founders is called Larry Harvey. And
it's a very nerdy name for a guy who's trying to be cutting-edge, avant-garde, you know.
It's kind of a... It's kind of a ruleless.
Oh yeah,
it's anarchic.
I'm sure it's
except for the 10 rules that guide it.
Oh, they have 10 rules.
There are 10 principles. They call them 10 principles.
Thou shalt not what?
Radical inclusion. So
everybody's
welcome.
You know, even the shittiest people of all time.
Billionaires.
Yes.
They can't get rid of the billionaires. The billionaires come to this.
They go there because for whatever fucking reason. I mean, they think that they're going to
be go there and they don't camp raw.
No,
they
of course
go
not.
There and they have like...
They fly in on their jet.
They essentially... They fly in on their private jet. They essentially have gated communities.
Yeah.
That where they have like deluxe latrines.
But they
want to feel
cool. Yeah, they want to
feel
cool.
But they want to feel like they're edgy and whatever. Okay, yeah, so...
Fuck those guys.
So at radical inclusion, gifting... So you have
like
gifting is like give things. And so, and it's not
share your shit.
And it's, well, and it's got to be gifting. It has to be like an exchange of something.
Right.
An
exchange is not gifting. Now you're bartering.
Well, no, but it's got to be like you give people things. It's, it is gifting.
Yeah.
All right. Decommodification.
Ladies, I got something to give you.
Well, that could be one of the things that you
I'm
give.
Sure. I will give you. Bodily fluids.
Give decommodification.
Right. So, you know, it's basically this kind of hippy-dippy, somewhat communistic economy.
It is communistic. Okay, radical self-reliance. So you're there and you are in charge of your
Bring
shit.
Your shit.
Bring your shit.
Figure it
and
out.
And take your shit out. Like, also literally. Radical self-expression.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
Communal effort. Civic responsibility.
Sure. Don't be a dick.
Leaving no trace. So like I said.
I guarantee you 100% there's definitely a trace at the end of the day.
Participation? So you can't not participate.
Well, you can, but they frown on it.
That's not good. No, you have to. This is one of the 10 principles. And then immediacy.
Do you think people are going to force you to participate?
Well, here's the thing. It's hive mind. So if you are there... And
there's a lot of social pressure.
There's social pressure to do whatever people are doing. So if around you, and this is a thing, nudity is a thing. They take
sure
their clothes
is.
Off.
Yes, they
and
do.
And if everyone around you is naked,
why not?
What are you going to do? The pressure is going to be to take your clothes off. So communal effort, civic responsibility, leaving no trace, participation, and immediacy. All right. So
what does that immediacy mean?
It has to happen right now. You can't make promises for later. It has to be. You have to be in the moment.
Wow.
You stay in the moment.
It seems very dictatorial.
Well, but also freeing.
Tell me how to feel.
Now, I was reading about this as I was like doing
You're
my research.
Go?
I kind of want to check it out.
I mean,
like it would be
first
interesting.
Of all, in
also
an idealistic way, yes, it does seem very interesting. But you have to realize that, as with anything, the most annoying people are going to just ruin it for you.
All right. So speaking of the most annoying people, and I mentioned it before, rich people. So there are rich people issues at Burning Man.
Right.
And there's like a people are taking offense to the fact that wealthy people, billionaires,
yeah,
actors and stuff, yeah, will, yeah, go to Burning Man. But
to they say, do, but I it, was, it's for their
I
gram.
Went to Burning Man.
It's for their gram.
And then they're like, you know, they're there and they don't do
but
it.
They're not really
they're
there.
They're not really there. Like Google employees went and did this.
Like,
and
you know
they
who
shipped
I,
in.
Fucking does it? Goddamn Gwyneth Paltrow.
Elon Musk does
oh,
it.
Oh, fuck that guy.
All right. That like Google employees sent out like just cases of lobster for yeah. one night.
It's like, fuck are you doing?
To be cooked. It's like, what are you doing? That's like totally against it. Also, it's.
How about sending them bottles of water and
is
sunscreen?
Is it a utopia? Like the idea
no,
is that
it's
a
not.
Utopia, but was it ever a utopia?
No, of course
no.
not.
And here's the thing. The racial mix. Do you want to guess?
97% white.
No.
100% white.
87% white.
Still, that's pretty white.
6% Hispanic, Latino, 6% Asian, 2% Native American.
No black people.
1% black people.
Yeah,
and the and Harvey, the guy, the co-founder, he said this. Black people just don't like to camp.
Okay,
wow.
Racist guy.
How about that inclusivity, right?
Yeah.
Like everyone is welcome. All right, so these are all the crowds. Now, I told you that I felt that there was one kind of underlying link to all of those things. And it might not just be one. It's like concepts that...
Go for it.
There's a concept
Lay
that
it on
underpins
us.
All of that.
I, along with our listening audience,
I want to
am
see
on
if
the
you can
edge
guess.
Of my seat.
I want to see if you can guess.
Oh. All right. So what am I trying to guess here?
There's a common value that kind of underpins probably most
all
of
crowds,
those. All of them.
Us versus
all,
them.
These crowds. So
is
what
it,
is, because there's like a, with crowds, because they are not reasonable, and we'll learn
right.
about that soon. But crowds are not reasonable, but they respond to certain concepts.
Right.
So what concept do you think kind of underpins all of those, all of the ones that I listed, except for maybe Burning Man, but even almost probably Burning Man?
Equality.
Equality is one.
Fraternity.
Yes.
Liberté.
Liberté. Right? Like all of the, oh, you're 100%, right?
Thank you. Well, you know, I'm quite good.
You're very smart.
Did I mention sola scriptura?
I know. But do you agree?
Of course, yeah. I mean, those are the best things to appeal to an oppressed group.
What do they mean?
So, liberty. Freedom mm-hmm. to do what you want. Because you've been oppressed, now you want to be liberated to be able to pursue whatever it is you want to pursue.
What is that? What does freedom really mean, though? What is freedom? Define, what does freedom mean? Do what you want to do. What does that mean?
I mean, is this homework? What are you doing?
I'm asking you give it a really hard, is it really definable? Or
well,
is it
look,
really kind
freedom
of amorphous?
Means, freedom means... without restriction, right? But that can mean a lot of different things. So freedom can mean without being oppressed by an other, right? It can mean the ability to pursue what it is you want to pursue. Tell me where you're going with this.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm just having a conversation
oh,
with
well,
you.
God
I'm
damn.
Not. I don't have
is
a
Is there
point.
An answer or not?
No, I'm just having this.
I'm taking
just,
the SATs here.
This is
I need to know which
Mark,
little circle to fill in.
Calm down.
Is this an essay question?
No. Quit it. It's just a question.
My teacher
just
told me not to.
To make us think about yeah. whether or not there are hard and we think we know what liberty means.
Right.
We think we know what equality means.
Right.
We think we know what
but
fraternity
we
means.
We generally
but,
think we want freedom, but you know, we don't want everybody to have absolute freedom.
Right.
We want there to be some restrictions, just not the ones that restrict us. Right?
Right.
Like, I want there to be laws that suit me.
Exactly.
Right? Because if we just have absolute freedom, that motherfucker over there holding a hammer could just cave my head in.
This is what we have to start thinking about when we start thinking about crowds. Because
right.
very often, crowds are motivated by these ideals, and they're very amorphous. They're
yeah,
not
they're not
really,
sophisticated and
it's
well-defined.
Like love.
Yeah.
What is...
We
want
to promote love. Well... I mean, ladies,
how do you,
what's up?
How do you?
I want to promote some love.
How do
I'm
going to
need that love now.
Everybody,
are you into
just,
it? Doesn't matter.
Just did a hand gesture.
Oh, yeah.
That is so off-putting.
Where I gesture towards my crotch when we talk about love. That's where I keep my love. What can I tell you?
Oh, gross. Oh, you're so disgusting.
I am disgusting.
Ew. All right. So... ultimately, we're going to get to the point where we understand that crowds have, they can't reason.
Right. I feel like crowds are mostly really motivated
by
negatives. Right.
Maybe, or
they're trying
emotions.
To avoid negatives because something bad is happening that they don't like.
Or something good is happening that they want to be a part of.
I think it's less likely that there's something good that's happening that they want to be a part of. Just because I don't think that's as strong a motivation. Not that it doesn't happen. By the way, if you ever want to see a great illustration of crowd mentality, watch The Life of Brian. They're basically running around looking, trying to force messiahdom on Brian. And then this totally normal human guy is now elevated to godhood. Right? Because the crowd, as you said, can't reason. They just feel and they follow whatever the tide is for the crowd.
As long as there is a charismatic presence a charismatic presence or a high-minded ideal or something that they can coalesce around. Now, of course, there are different theories about this. So as we have discussed, crowds have existed forever. We've shown that.
Right. As long as you have more than five people, I would say.
So this is not something new, but what was new is the idea of looking at crowds and saying, hang on.
How's that happening?
How is that happening?
What are the mechanics?
Now, through time, people recognized that crowds were crowds and that they responded to stimuli. Let's talk about the Romans.
Right.
What did the mob respond to in Rome? You must know this.
They were mollified by bread and circuses to a point.
Yeah, up until a point.
Until they weren't.
Until they weren't. And then they found what? Christianity.
Correct.
And other things. Okay, and so then crusades, for instance.
Yeah.
Crusades happen because knights in Europe are marauding against other Europeans.
Yes.
And the Pope says, hey, you know what? Let's...
You know what? I have a different marauding target.
And they're urinating...
I have a mitre on my head.
They're urinating on relics. That was the thing.
And exactly.
let's send you out to fight with them.
We have an other, which is very handy if you want to rile up a crowd.
Let's go and get them. One of the earliest. I'm not going to say the earliest, but one of the earliest works on crowds that I was able to find was Charles McKay's 1841 study, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. He talks about things like economic bubbles. So he was talking about the tulip.
Yeah, the tulip bubble.
Yep.
One of the most famous economic bubbles of all time where people just went out of their fucking minds investing in tulip futures.
Right.
They got it in their head that
tulips were worth a lot.
Tulips were, well, and they were, right? Like some of the rarer tulips were worth money. Why are these tulips intrinsically valuable? Well, they're blue. Well, okay. And like, is that going to change? Is that going to cure cancer?
No.
Is that going to feed the masses?
But is a tulip meant to cure cancer? I don't think that's
fair. No, it's not.
That's not a fair comparison.
But the thing is there was no real intrinsic value
to
there was just speculative value.
Yeah. So he talked about economic bubbles.
Yes.
He talked about witch mania. We haven't talked about that, but witch mania was a huge thing.
Clear crowdsourced.
Very crowd.
Craziness.
Alchemy.
Yeah.
The belief that you could change things into gold.
Right.
All right. So what he actually talks about is just kind of like multiple different levels of crowds. And so there's that, and that is a thing. There are different kinds of crowds. And so there are some crowds that are, you know, trying to do political things. There are some crowds that are just trying to have fun. There are some crowds that are trying to find like-minded people for comfort. I don't know. Conspiracy theorist, right?
Sure.
Then there are crowds that think they have a common goal that is a good goal,
right?
But it might be a little sketchy, like a little culty. But the real analysis of crowd psychology has its roots
in
true crime. Let's start thinking about why criminals are criminals. And they start doing this and they sort of go through this whole phase of like, well, a criminal must look like a criminal. If they're a bad guy, they have
phylogeny.
This.
Yeah,
so they
great.
Look at their faces and they say, well, they have this big nose. And that big nose person must
the
be
big
a criminal.
Brow ridge.
Or they're ugly. So
hair coming out of your nose.
That's
whatever.
Right. That's
horns,
why like
the they don't like horns.
The elephant man was, you know, that people would throw rocks at him because they thought that he was a bad guy.
Now, have you seen the movie?
I know it's tragic. All right. So, like I said, it has its roots in true crime. Late 19th century thinkers began discussing criminality, and the first debate in crowd psychology happened in Rome at the first International Congress of Criminal Anthropology.
What year was that?
November 16th, 18. 18- 1985.
Right before they actually did real science. They're right. Like, we're feeling scientific. We really don't know how it works.
No, they were doing science.
Yeah-ish.
So they had some pseudosciences, but we still have some pseudosciences.
We sure do.
Some of the theorists in crowd behavior.
Yeah.
Let's talk about theorists and theories. So Sigmund Freud.
Oh, the Freud dude.
Is big into this. His crowd behavior theory primarily consists
about your mama?
No, of the idea that becoming a member of a crowd serves to unlock the unconscious mind. So Freud has this idea that there's this unconscious mind that we just don't have access
to. And you could call it like the reptile brain, right? It's that primitive, not intellectual, right?
Right. It's not intellectual. This occurs,
if it's not intellectual, I ain't about that.
So it unlocks the unconscious mind, and this occurs because the superego, or moral center of consciousness, like the thing that makes us...
The prude in your soul.
This is displaced by the larger crowd and is replaced by a charismatic crowd leader. All of a sudden, your unconscious is
activated. I gotta have somewhere to put these feelings.
And this person is speaking to my soul. Like that is what it probably feels like.
Because you have all these emotions that you're looking for a place to focus them and put them, and this person provides that, right? They're like a lightning rod. They are a focal point for your...
They translate what your unconscious is screaming to tell you.
They're like, this guy is speaking to me.
In a crowd, the overall shared emotional experience reverts to the least common denominator, leading to primitive levels of emotional expression. This organizational structure is that of the primal horde.
Who said that?
Freud. Pre-civilized society. Yeah. And Freud states that one must rebel against the leader, which is to reinstate the individual morality. So you're giving up your individual values.
Yes.
To the crowd, whatever the crowd value
is. You're subsuming your ego to the crowd.
So in order to get out of that, you have to rebel against somebody who is now, has been for some time, potentially. The longer the amount of time that you've allowed that relationship to continue where you are really subsuming your own individual morality, the harder it is to rebel against that person who has, I don't know, like stating what they think or what you think that your unconscious
really
needs.
And I think the bottom line is, Robespierre, you should have run for the hills. Like you had, if you had studied Freud, you would have known you got to get the fuck. Freud. You got to GTFO, my brother, because you're gonna get Freud. You're next on the chopping block.
Freud came out about 100 years too late.
Well, I mean, you know, thanks a lot, Freud. I could have really used that advice 100 years ago.
All right. So another theory in crowd psychology is convergence theory.
Wow, that sounds super fancy and very mystical and crazy.
Convergence theory holds that crowd behavior is not a product of the crowd. But rather the crowd is a product of the coming together of like-minded individuals.
Well, okay. So I think there's probably some circularity. Is that even a word?
It is a circular argument. Floyd Allport argued that an individual in a crowd behaves just as he would behave alone, only more so.
I'm going to be more so like me. I'm super me. Yeah, exactly. I'm like me on steroids.
Right, but I think...
And I'm literally on steroids right now.
But wouldn't that feel like I'm finally being seen?
Well, I think But I think that finally being seen then encourages extremism, right? Because then you feel justified in everything you ever thought, and you're like, I'm all in, and we're going to hang somebody or chop their heads off, possibly.
So convergence theory, I have to tell you, is attractive to me. This idea, like this theory. Yeah. I like this theory.
Is it Jungian in any way? Because
that's where...
Honestly, if you ever want to get Christina on your side, just invoke Jung in any way.
just be talking. It can be nothing to do with him. Say Carl
Jung. What,
and
Christina?
I'm like, what?
Yeah, you know what, Christina? This feels kind of like the collective unconscious. You're like, yes.
Yes,
that's
I'm there.
Right.
Christina, have you ever done any shadow work?
Yeah,
I don't know. What? Yes.
Yes. We're of a like mind. You're so gullible.
All right. So then there's the emergent norm theory. That states that crowds have little unity at their outset, but during a period of sort of getting to know each other, they call it milling about.
See, I would have thought that the emergent norm theory would have to do with being recognized at your local bar. Kind of like
Norm.
I am when we go, hey, it's like, what's shaking, Norm? All four cheeks and a couple of chins. That's not the cumulative norm theory?
No. The emergent norm theory.
Whatever.
All right. So crowds have little unity at outset.
Right.
They're just people milling about. And all
but
of a sudden,
they start coalescing around some craziness.
They coalesce around the appropriate actions that are suggested by key members.
Yeah. So let's think about QAnon. Now, on its face, that is fucking nuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
JFK Jr. is not alive. Yeah, he's super dead, and he's not coming back. Neither is, by the way, JFK Sr., who would be 135 years old at this point. But in their hive mind, this has become a popular idea. And all these people are people who are angry about certain things, and somebody who is an authority figure in this movement says some bullshit crazy thing, and they're
probably
like
probably about love,
yeah,
or liberty,
yeah,
or something
fraternity,
amorphous,
yeah,
right.
And like, this is our way of getting what we want,
right.
And they're like, yes, I could be crazy for a while for this.
I could believe in this.
Yeah,
okay.
And I'm in. I'm all in.
So key members are identified through distinctive personalities or behaviors, and the following members fall in line, forming the basis for the crowd's norms. The key members garner attention, and the lack of negative response elicited from the crowd as a whole stands as tacit agreement. So you might not even agree really with that member, but as long as long as you're not stepping up and saying you're full of shit, what you're saying is nuts. As long as you just sit back and go, well,
okay, whatever.
He is for liberty.
Yeah.
So I'm going to not say much because even though I disagree with a lot of the rhetoric, I agree with the idea of liberty. And as long as that person at some point, you know, they might be saying all kinds of crazy shit, but they throw out the idea of liberty.
So we've talked about these dynamics. Do you think this boils down to a crisis of meaning for the people who are involved in these crowds?
100%.
Right? Because they're like, look, I'm looking for somewhere to put my beliefs, my faith, my allegiance, and this is what I've found.
But let me ask you
this. And I want to be in this group.
All right, but let me ask you this. Is it really a crisis if everyone is in some way struggling to be a part of a crowd?
Well, it's only a crisis up until the point where you think you found your meaning.
If everybody is in a crisis, is it a crisis?
Of course. Because if you, I mean,
or look, is it just the natural state of being?
But I think what we're talking about is something a little bit more than that.
Okay.
Where they're looking for meaning, not solutions to specific problems necessarily, not comfort, not happiness, but they want meaning. And they like, I have all these feels and I'm looking for a place to put them. And I want to belong to something. And when you are in a crowd and you're going along with them, you belong. You're all on the same team. You're all storming the Capitol. And remember the three things. Now you've got fraternity. You've got people, like-minded people who are on your side. And it feels good. It feels good to be in a group that accepts you, that you share ideals with.
Emergent norm theory.
Oh, norm!
allows for both positive and negative mob types.
Oh, absolutely.
The distinctive characteristics and behaviors of key figures can be positive or negative in nature.
Right.
An antisocial leader can incite violent action, but an influential voice of nonviolence in a crowd can lead to a mass sit-in.
Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Jr.
Right? When a crowd described as above targets an individual, antisocial behaviors may emerge within its members.
Okay.
All right. Social identity theory. This is the last one before we head into the conclusion here. Social identity theory posits that the self is a complex system made up primarily of the concept of membership or non-membership in various social groups.
That's a pretty bold statement,
but
let's
like
talk about it.
I feel like that's not necessarily wrong. These groups have various moral and behavioral values and norms, and the individual's actions depend on which group membership or non-membership is most personally salient at the time of action. So this one allows for membership in multiple groups.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's true. Which I think is realistic.
We all belong right. to multiple groups.
Like, I'm not just in the group of people who are politically liberal. I'm also in other groups. I'm in the group of people who don't believe in a deity of any sort. I'm in the group of people who think laser movies are very good, right? I'm in the group of people that think soccer is proper football, mm-hmm. right? I'm in a lot of groups. Maybe, yeah, I'd have to think about it. I'm not sure that my actions are dictated at all times by what group I think I'm in.
Okay, this influence is evidenced by findings that when the stated purpose and values of a group changes, the values and motives of its members also change. So if you're in a football group,
proper football,
and their views change in some way.
They're like, you know what? There should be more than 3 substitutions allowed per game.
Are you going to fight against that? Or are you going to say no, that absolutely not?
I don't know. That's a good question. So if everybody in the football community.
You might say, I don't really like that, but would you give up proper football?
Oh, no. God, no.
All right. So you would roll with the changes.
Yeah. Unless they start putting helmets on, I'm with proper football for life.
So this theory says that crowds are an amalgam of individuals, all of whom belong to various overlapping groups. However, if the crowd is primarily related to some identifiable group, like Christians or Hindus,
white people,
then the values of that group will dictate the crowd's action. In the crowds which are more ambiguous, individuals will assume a new social identity as a member of the crowd. This group membership is made more salient by confrontation with other groups.
Yeah, you have to have another.
So you have to have another. Yes.
I've said this right from the beginning.
But this kind of crowd is more really crowd dependent. It's more about the crowd.
It's more about the crowd controlling the individual.
Instead of there being a real leader. There may be some kind of a leader within this kind of a group, but it is really more about the crowd.
And how that organically kind of.
I'm not as convinced about this one because I think that there has to be some kind of thought leader.
Because it's very difficult, because as you pointed out, crowds can't really reason.
They don't reason. So
they just
so
kind of, just these, they believe and they act.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So they're not going to sit down and go, well, I'm going to have to write a manifesto now. The crowd doesn't do that. Now, an individual might do that. That's a pretty, you know, that's basically crowd leadership 101. Get some kind of manifesto, a philosophy, some statement of beliefs, and then try to persuade, impose, whatever, those beliefs on your crowd.
That could be. I think that there is that, but that manifesto has to be,
from the foundation.
It has to really dig into what is going on in that crowd, what the zeitgeist is of the crowd. Okay, let's wrap this up by saying that in our next episode, because this is going to be 3 very interrelated episodes.
Right.
I'm really trying
to. So very incestuous episodes.
I'm really trying to build an argument here.
I'm with you.
But okay, so there's one theory that originated in the late 19th century that influenced 20th century leaders ranging from Hitler to Stalin to Churchill to Roosevelt, and which underpins a number of the theories that we just discussed.
Yes.
And that is the work of Gustave Le Bon.
Le Bon, who is the great-grandfather of the lead singer of Duran Duran.
No, we don't know that. No. There's Mark made that up. So Gustave Le Bon argues that crowds exist in 3 stages: submergence, contagion, and suggestion. We're going to dive deep into how his theory works.
Now, has he gone too far this time? Is he dancing on the Valentine in any way?
He stopped drawing the correlation between Simon and Gustav.
You are not going to be able to escape that in any way in the next episode. I'm going to be 100% committed to that joke.
All right, so we're going to be talking about his theory and what he has to say about how crowds work. Because what I did as I was reading all of these, I kind of went, you know what? They all refer to him, many of them refer to him. Has there been revision? Yes. But also his work, it really resonated with me.
Right. There are certain parts of it that are problematic.
There are problematic areas, I think, and we'll get into that, but he says a lot of stuff that really makes sense. And in the end, his work informed so much of what happened in the 20th century, which turned out to be effective. A lot of the way the world is now is because those guys looked at what he talked about and said, well, that makes sense. Let's apply his theory.
His grandson, great-grandson is no less influential.
God damn it. That is not his great-grandson.
You don't know that. You don't even know. You didn't even look into that.
All right. So we're going to talk about submergence, contagion, and suggestion and how that works in our next episode.
All right, I'm ready.
All right, so Mark, did you enjoy this conversation?
I did.
Let's invite people to come and follow us on social media. We have...
I would be delighted if they would do that.
A Twitter. I have a new Twitter, everyone.
You do.
At Christina with a K. So Christina Gen X.
That's right. Mine is the same old...
At Mark Eats Peach. You can still follow me on at Serious Produce, but I'm going to be talking about produce-related
things. It's like literally produce just like oranges and shit.
Yeah. And so, but come and follow me on at Christina Gen X on Twitter. And we have a Facebook group at Gen X Temporaneous.
By the way, even though she didn't mention it, we have a podcast Twitter, Extemporaneous 2.
That's correct.
And that's where all the shit happens.
That's where we post everything about the podcast. Right. All right, everyone, thank you for coming and listening to us each week. We really appreciate it. I'm going to say bye.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.
Wow.
For your income, right? It was just straight.
Do you think they were okay with it being called the peasant revolution? Like, do you think they would want to call it something like the economically disadvantaged or the differently wealthed
revolution? I don't know if they were that pretentious.
Well,
I think they just got their pitchforks and came marauding out of Kent.
It's like, anybody have torches? Yeah, 4 pence.
Okay.
Per torch.